All right. What I want to do today is we're going to move on into verses 9 and 10. But since last week's was not recorded, and for the benefit of those who are wanting to keep up with the study by way of CD, and also for us, because it certainly doesn't help for us to continually review where we have been, I want to back up just a little bit and cover the high points of what we've talked about so far in this study. It is going to be crucial that we continually keep in mind and keep before us the very important things that we're learning in the first chapter of the book, and some of the historical and archaeological and other issues that I am providing with you as we progress through this study and progress at something of a slow pace, perhaps. I don't know, perhaps some of you had hoped we'd be in chapter 10 by now, but we're obviously not going to move that quickly. But I think one thing that would be helpful for us to keep in mind, and I came across this very well stated in a totally unrelated source. This is from a book written by a rabbi on Hasidic tales. The Hasidic movement in Judaism is one that relies very heavily on parables and very interesting stories to illustrate important truths from the Bible and Jewish tradition. And Rabbi Zalman, in this book, in talking about these Hasidic teachings that come to us from a different time and different places than at least the English-speaking West, most of them come from Eastern Europe, he has this little section in his book. He says, "Now the question that is relevant to the teachings of the Hasidic masters is this," and I think, obviously, I'm applying this to our study of the book of Revelation in particular, and we could apply it to the Bible in general. "How am I to understand sources that come from the past? The answer is, I cannot deal with the sources from the past unless I go back to the mindset, to the reality map, to the paradigm of the past. If I try to judge the paradigm of the past with my understanding of the present, I'm going to find myself in trouble. That is because I will judge everything as being lesser," or I think he could just as well say inferior. "Look how funny they were to believe that," or "how stupid they were back then." Rabbi Zalman writes, "From that point of view, I wouldn't give credit to Plato, Aristotle, Moses, or Buddha. He didn't know about quantum mechanics. Moses didn't know that E equals MC squared. If I go and judge it in this way, I cannot possibly estimate and esteem the true contribution of these people. So," he says, and this is, I think, key, "I must see them in terms of the world that they occupied and the worldview that they had." And this is something that I have tried to stress in this study. And these are just the basic principles, or at least some of the basic principles, of good biblical interpretation. Some of the more strange and bizarre and outlandish teachings that come down the pike about what the Bible supposedly teaches come from people who don't take what Rabbi Zalman said seriously and these basic principles of biblical interpretation. And we could say, since he's not talking about the Bible per se, anything that comes from the past has to be read in its context. Now, what I would like to do is hand out to you a little sheet that I hope you will find helpful. And I'm going to hand one on each side. There should be more than enough. If the last person to get that on the back row would just keep it back there, and as new people come in, if you would make sure that other folks get copies of it and that they eventually make their way back up to me at the end of the class. Now, I want to start, first of all, on this sheet by way, again, of review with the key points from chapter 1 of the Apocalypse. And on the back, you'll find a map. We'll talk about the map in just a moment. And please hang on to this because you'll find this helpful throughout the study. Well, let's go ahead and look at the map, because I may not get to this the part where he talks about the seven churches. But you see on the back, in the top location, a larger panned out view of this part of the world. And you see the island of Patmos just off the coast of what is today Turkey, and the city of Ephesus. You see where it's located. And then the larger map at the bottom, the Roman province of Asia as it existed in that time, And you see again Patmos off there, a little island. And you see the locations of these seven churches to whom the letters are being written. And I told you, I believe last week, how the locations of these churches and the order in which they're addressed in the book of Revelation actually represent a Roman postal route and the sequence in which a letter carrier would have visited these different cities and these different churches in these cities. So there again is an example of how the context plays a crucial role to our understanding. That becomes important because you see the dispensationalists in particular, if you are even remotely familiar with their teachings, they look upon these seven churches, well, they might tip the hat to the fact that they were literal places and literal churches, but they want to see a larger dispensational significance in that, well, you've got the age of the Laodicean church, and this church, the church at Ephesus, represents a different age of the church. Well, it has nothing to do with what John is talking about, the author of Revelation. These are real churches facing real problems. Now, let's start with number one on the key points. What is about to be revealed? These are all things, again, by way of review, that we have talked about so far, and for those who are relying on the CD because of the material that was not recorded last week, I want to put all this up front before we move on to verses 9 and 10. What is about to be revealed or unveiled to John will be done, I should say by, not my. thing about spell checkers, it can make sure you got the right word, spelled correctly, but not the right word. Will be done by means of semino. Semino, which means signifying. That is, to make known through imagery or symbols or metaphorical speech. And that's found in verse chapter 1, verse 1. And the New King James, the King James, and Young's Literal Translation, the YLT, they retain the full meaning of the Greek by using that word signify in their translation. If you happen to have the New King James and you look up Revelation 1:1, that's what it says. And he signified it. Now, some other translations have he showed or made known, and it certainly means that as well. But it's obvious in the context that signify is far more accurate because symbols and metaphorical speech are what's being used. Now, that is very important. This is a book of symbols and imagery. And something else, a little saying that you can write down and remember, I've told you this one so already. This book was not written to you, but for you. And here's another little catchy phrase that would be helpful. The things that we're going to be reading, especially the more flowery statements, They don't mean what they say. They mean what they mean. And that goes right back to what the quote from Rabbi Zelman is talking about. When something comes to us from a vast difference of time, in a different language, a different culture, and we've already been told right away in verse 1, this is going to be sort of a technicolor, flowery expression of visions. It doesn't necessarily mean what it says. It means what it means. Another thing that you need to keep in mind is that just because the book has been divided up into chapters and verses, and it seems to sort of unfold for us as we read it in some sort of sequential chronological order, that's not necessarily the case. There's nothing here that indicates the timing of these visions, as though John had one and then the other and then 2 hours later the other one, and this sort of thing. It maybe appears to us, and we sort of form this working assumption, but that is not necessarily the case. We aren't to read into the unfolding of just because we go chapter 1 through 22 that that's how it happened for him. And remember, or be aware in case you don't know to remember, when the text of the book of Revelation originally came to us from the Greek, and the manuscripts that we have of it that still exist, most of them date from the Middle Ages, but they're based on manuscripts that go back much earlier. They didn't have chapter divisions, they didn't have verses. All those things were added much, much later. All right, so the second point, does everybody have this? Those folks that just came in, does anybody need a copy of this? All right. The second point, the content of the visions that are about to be revealed to John related to the things that are to happen soon, quickly. For the time is near at hand. These time indicators locate the events being signified in the time in which the author is writing the book. And the time indicators are in verse 1 and in verse 3. Thirdly, the statement in chapter 1, verse 7, And I mentioned last week that if there is a, quote, key verse, and I'm not sure that there is. I mean, in one sense, there are several key verses, or in some sense, they're all key verses, but this one is definitely crucial. It's very important if it's not a key verse. The statement in chapter 1, verse 7, further locates the events being foreseen in the time in which the book was written. It further indicates that the visions are to reveal both the vindication of the saints of God, that is, the followers of Israel's true Messiah, Jesus, and the crushing of their enemies, the leaders of Israel who colluded with Rome to wipe out the Church of Jesus. You see, this book is based very much on the Older Testament writings. One of the reasons that I'm trying to do this class now, because I want you to, in some way, try to make the connection between our study through the book of Exodus and what we're reading here. The great motif of the book of Exodus is God destroying the enemies of the Israelites, God bringing his people out of bondage and confounding their enemies. And this is a theme that rebounds all through the Old Testament. God punishes Israel, or they're facing persecution for one reason or another, and their deliverance is the flip side of their enemies being defeated or crushed. And the book of Revelation very much is in that vein. The people of God now have been reconstituted. The new Israel have been reconstituted as the true Israel, the followers of the true Messiah of Israel, Jesus. They're being savagely persecuted. But who are persecuting them? It's primarily the Jews. It's primarily the leaders of Israel. These were the people who stood in opposition to the spread of the gospel in that time. That may not be something we like to talk about, but it's the reality if we're going to properly understand what's going on in this book. Now, the Romans were certainly a part of that, and they would become a larger part of it, but when we examine the reasons, the Romans originally could have cared less about the Christians. As far as they knew, they were just another sect of Jews. But in almost every instance where we have a record of persecution by the Christians in the earliest days, I mean up to and including about 125, A.D. 125, but in this time immediately with the spread of the gospel beyond the boundaries of Jerusalem up to the time of the severe Roman persecutions, the persecutions were either directly instituted and initiated and carried out by Jews or by getting the various Jewish leaders in various cities to go to the Romans and say, okay, you got to stop these people. So then, this is the theme of the book. The people of God versus their enemies, and God trouncing their enemies. These people are being horribly persecuted. They're being crushed. And so John writes this letter. Now, I want you to, let's look at some passages here that further support this. Could I have a volunteer to read Matthew 10:23? Somebody, okay, Gene, Matthew 10:23, Matthew 16:27-28. Sam Starrett, would you read that, please? Matthew 23:34-38. Jim Flynn, and Luke 21:20-22. Tom, please. Luke 21:20-22. Matthew 10:23, Matthew 16:27-28, Matthew 23:34-38, Luke 21:20-22. Now, what I want you to see from these verses is that it wasn't John who just sort of conjured this up. This comes already earlier from the words of Jesus himself. Jesus was talking about this very thing, about the leadership of Israel becoming the enemies of God through their rejection of God's true Messiah. Jesus is the true Israel. So if you're going to be a part of Israel, you've got to be a part of Israel's true Messiah. And if you reject him, you become an enemy of God, the Father, who sent him. All right, Matthew 10:23. Jesus is speaking to his disciples. And he, read the last part of that again, Gene. Friends, there's only two ways about this. Either Jesus was wrong, or he was right. Either he knew what he was talking about, or he didn't know what he's talking about. What else can it mean when he tells them, you will not have gone to the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes? He's talking about a persecution. He's talking about them being persecuted because they're going around spreading the gospel. But he's telling them, you will not have finished this before I come, quote unquote. In some sense, he's coming before they even finish doing that. in the cities of Israel. Okay, Matthew 16, 27 to 28. We're going to see here that Jesus continually made this statement about his coming, and it was all going to take place within the lifetime of the people to whom he was speaking. Matthew 16, 27 to 28. Here again, this is another statement, and as we go through these, understand that the fact from the point of view of many people that this did not happen in the sense of a cataclysmic, you know, utopian coming to the end of the world, Jesus literally returns and rules in the temple at Jerusalem, the fact that that didn't happen has led many people to conclude that these accounts are simply incorrect, that they can't be inspired, wholly inerrant and without error, because obviously Jesus made a mistake. Well, yeah, if that's what he intended to mean, but that's not what he meant. And as I showed you last time, this language of God coming in judgment is often couched in these extreme metaphorical ways, but it doesn't mean that what's being spoken of, the vehicle by which the thing is being expressed, is going to be literally coming true. God didn't come into Egypt riding a cloud. That was a way of saying God would bring his judgment against Egypt, which he did do. That literally happened. But the way it was expressed was it was expressed in prophetic language. Here Jesus does the same thing. Some of you are standing here will not taste death until you see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom or coming in his glory. All right, Matthew 23, 34 to 38. Now this passage is very crucial because this is Jesus speaking, and this is just before the giving of the Olivet Discourse, which most people today agree, even many evangelicals who used to think otherwise have almost been forced to agree because of the clear evidence that if not all of Matthew 24, then at least a major chunk of it is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Jesus is predicting the destruction of Jerusalem. But notice what he says before he gets to that point. He's just been reviling and basically damning the Pharisees in this chapter 23. And listen to what he says in these verses, Matthew 23, 34 to 38. All right, these words are pregnant with eschatological meaning. As you hear them, they don't have the same impact on your ears, believe me, as the disciples of Jesus when they heard them and as the Pharisees heard them. This was a damning indictment. This was a severe proclamation of destruction and judgment that were to come upon who? Upon you will come all the righteous judgment. You not only kill the prophets in the past, I'm going to send you prophets and disciples and apostles, and you're going to kill them. And because you're going to commit this ultimate act of breaking covenant with God, upon you, Israel, upon you, the leaders of the Jews, will come all of this righteous judgment. And then he turns right there, and he laments for Jerusalem. He clearly links something's going to happen to Jerusalem, the old Jerusalem, and he's in deep agony over what's going to be happening. But there's a very important statement there about the timing. What did it say, Jim? All these things. All of this will come upon this generation. There's no amount of hermeneutical, biblical, interpretive yoga that's going to get you out of the fact that he clearly located this as happening in that time. And again, because people misunderstand exactly what he was describing, they think he meant the end of the world. And again, because that obviously didn't happen, they think he was wrong. But when you again understand what he's talking about, he wasn't wrong. Because in AD 70, it happened 40 years after he said that it would happen. And then finally, Luke's version of this same Olivet Discourse that's given in Matthew 24, Luke 21, 20 to 22, Tom.
But when you see Jerusalem swept under by an army,
Let me stop you there. Thank you. When you see, who's he talking to? The people who were sitting there listening to him. When you see the armies surrounding Jerusalem, know that its desolation is near. And then he makes that concluding statement that these are the days of vengeance. What does he mean by that? What's the vengeance for? The persecution of his church. The persecution of the true Israel. By who? Or by whom? Excuse me. When your ancestors destroyed my part of the country, but our education system didn't improve very much, and so I'm the beneficiary of a public school system in the South. That's an excuse for not properly learning the English language. But anyway, who is he talking about? He's talking about the leaders of the Jews. He links all of this with Jerusalem. If it was the Romans who were the ones upon whom the vengeance was going to be taken, at least in that particular time period, he wouldn't be wiping out Jerusalem. But that's exactly what happened. All right. Point four on the handout, and some of these other folks that just came in, let's make sure they're getting the handout. Steve, we never got the roll. I don't know where it is. So probably so, yes. The apocalypse, number four, is symbolically divided into seven sections as follows. Now, I haven't talked about this before, but this is another indication that you can't read this book like any other book. This isn't like reading the Times Union or the Gazette. The prologue of the book is first of all, and it's verses 1 to 8. We've already covered those. And then follow seven parallel sections that divide at the verses that I've listed there, and that also includes the epilogue. Now, isn't that interesting? You've got seven parallel sections that are built around seven visions that he has. But then notice in number five, the predominance of this number seven. Look at all the number sevens that are associated here. Seven lampstands, seven stars, seven flaming torches, seven spirits of God, seven eyes, seven seals, seven angels, seven trumpets, seven thunders, seven heads on a dragon, seven plagues, seven bowls of wrath, seven mountains, seven kings, and praises presented to the Lamb of God. And there are also seven Beatitudes. Blessed are those, or blessed are they, throughout the book. And those, there are the verses. Now that, again, is a good indication that this is not to be read as any other book. It wasn't written to be read in that same fashion. Somebody doesn't just set out to write a factual account of things that are going to happen, and you just have all these sevens turning up. This was an invention. This was intended to be this way. It's a style of writing that was common in that day. And that's another example of the symbolism that's present in the book. All right, are there any questions before we move on to verse 9? All right, excuse me, Jim. Yes, and many people are convinced, let me back up, some people are convinced, and some scholars of no mean repute, I mean people who know the languages, they know the scriptures very well, that even when Peter is using similar language about the heaven and earth passing away, and the elements, that he uses this imagery of destruction of heavenly bodies, that is another way of expressing the same thing. When you are a Jew living in that time and you're looking for language to express what is about to come upon the holy city, you draw on this kind of imagery. It is, in some literal sense, the end of the world for you. All right, let's move on to verse 9. The author continues, I, John, your brother, who share with you in Jesus the tribulation and kingdom and the patient endurance, was on the island called Patmos on account of the word of God and the testimony of Jesus. Now, in this passage, he's talking about, he uses this term, I was in the tribulation. Now, this is something else we need to focus on for just a moment, because this statement actually functions as an introduction to the first of the seven visions that will make up the rest of the content of the book. And he's in a state of suffering, but it's a fraternal suffering. He's undergoing suffering with the fellow believers. And he is, notice what he calls himself. Now, if we assume that the author is John the Apostle, which is the traditional position, it's very significant that he doesn't refer to himself in some high, exalted, monarchical type way. I am John the Beloved Disciple. I, John, the Patriarch of the West, Archbishop and Metropolitan of all humanity. No, he says, I'm your brother. And then the fraternal bond is one both of covenantal union. He's their brother in Christ. He's been baptized. But also in the commonalities of their persecution and suffering. He is their companion in tribulation, or in the tribulation, and in patient endurance. And being a fellow partaker in the tribulation, he must be speaking of something very, very specific. He's not talking about tribulation generally. Now, you can be... let me rephrase that. Not all tribulation amounts to persecution, but all persecutions do amount to tribulation. I mean, you can be facing trials and tribulations and it not necessarily be related to being persecuted for your faith. But if you're being persecuted for your faith, that is a type of a tribulation. And the followers of Jesus were forewarned by him that their lives would be ones of trial and difficulty as we follow the Lord and as they follow the Lord. But I think there's something more in mind here. And if you will turn quickly with me to Matthew 24, verse 21. Matthew 24, 21. Now, in this place, Jesus is speaking concerning, he's talking on the Mount of Olives concerning the destruction of Jerusalem and the judgment that was to come against the leadership of Israel and the nation of Israel for their rejection of him. And in chapter 24, verse 21, in these very famous and memorable words, he says, "For then will be great tribulation, such as not been from the beginning of the world until now and never will be." And then in the Gospel of Mark is the parallel statement of that in Mark 13:24. "But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light," etc. Jesus is talking about what was coming upon Jerusalem as so horrific. He's using this exalted language to express this in a way that there's nothing like this that has ever happened, and it won't happen again. It's so bad. I don't know that we should take that in an absolute literalistic sense, but we will at some point get into some of the dynamics. Some of you know we've talked about this in other contexts, but what happened when the Romans laid siege to Jerusalem beginning in AD 66 and culminating in AD 70 was simply unspeakably horrific, to put it mildly. And so he's speaking of this as the great tribulation. You know, many people, they lay awake at night after reading the Left Behind series and they think this horrific tribulation is coming on the world and, oh, I got to get up in the rapture or else I'm going to be, oh, it's going to be horrific. And, you know, it's sort of a boo Christianity. You know, you better believe this or this is what's going to happen to you. And when people really understand what the Bible is saying, that for some folks, it's a real liberation. I mean, they really get a hold of the fact that I don't have to be worried about this. I'm a member of God's kingdom. I follow Jesus. And that's something else. Let me jump ahead of myself here a little bit. Notice what he says. I share with you in Jesus the tribulation and what? What else is he sharing with them besides the tribulation? The kingdom. Now, don't you think that if the kingdom is something that's yet to come, which the dispensationalists believe that, that's what they teach. Nope, the kingdom's not here. It won't happen until Jesus returns and sets up his throne in Jerusalem and all that, you know, defeats the Antichrist and all that sort of thing. These words make no sense if that's the case. The kingdom has already come. It's in the process of spreading and becoming more prevalent. But that wouldn't make any sense if the kingdom was yet to be fulfilled. Well, anyway, the great tribulation then is what he's talking about, and these verses indicate that in Revelation 7:14, if we jump ahead just a moment, He says, I said to him, sir, you know, and he said to me, these are they who have come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. The tribulation was something that was going to go on and be in terms of what was happening to the church in this time frame from when Jesus ascended to heaven to the time of his judgment coming against Israel. That was a time of intense persecution against the church of Jesus. And that's what he's referring to. All of the things that Jesus talks about in Matthew 24, the falling away, brother turning against brother, the earthquakes, the famines, all of those things happened in that time frame. I'm not going to go into that right now, but I will at some point flesh that out as we go along. The problem is, again, just like that quote, some of you were not here. Let me read this again. This is a quote from Rabbi Zalman in a book he wrote about reading Hasidic tales that come to us from a different time. How am I to understand sources, stories, information that comes from the past? I cannot deal with the sources from the past unless I go back to the mindset, to the reality map, to the paradigm of the past. If I try to judge the paradigm of the past with my understanding of the present, I'm going to find myself in trouble. So I must see these stories, and I, by extension, am applying this to what's given to us in Revelation, in terms of the world that they occupied and the worldview that they had. Now, since Jesus proclaimed the tribulation that precedes the fall of Jerusalem, and that's what he did in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 21, to be the greatest, that is the worst since the beginning, then the great tribulation, or the tribulation that John refers to, must surely be one and the same as spoken by Jesus. And it's notable that John speaks in one breath, as I have already said, of this tribulation and of the kingdom. And this is another indicator that firmly places the events being spoken of and signified in the book in that generation. John speaks of his sharing with them in the present time. These three things: persecution, the tribulation, the kingdom, and the endurance. He speaks not of a kingdom that awaits a literal returning of Jesus to become a reality. He speaks not of a patient endurance that is yet to be rallied. All of these were in force and in place at the time in which he was writing. And then he next informs his readers that he was on the island of Patmos. And just in case some of you are very sharp in your thinking, you think, I got him. I was on the island of Patmos. I've been making the case to you that this is all very present tense kind of stuff, and here appears to be something that's a past tense statement. Well, it happens to be in the aorist form, suggesting completed action in the past, but that does not in any way militate against the contemporary first century setting of the work and the content. I could just as easily say, well, I was in my car on the way to church here just a while ago. That doesn't mean it happened 500 years ago. It happened this morning. Now, the island of Patmos, if you've got the little handout, you can locate it on the map. It was a rocky, desolate island about 35 miles west of the city of Miletus in Asia Minor. And according to the Roman historian Tacitus, several of these Aegean islands were used as penal locations, places of banishment. Now, there were people living there. There were some temples to Artemis and various other things. It wasn't just a penal colony. It was also a place where Roman citizens lived. And so it is that John finds himself there for his witness and testimony about Jesus. Now, some have suggested that he was there for missionary, evangelistic purposes. It's not very likely that he was there for that reason, and most scholars agree he was there for his missionary, evangelistic purposes in other places. That's how he wound up there. He may have engaged in that activity while he was there, but he was there for reasons of punishment. Now, let's move on to verse 10. And here, again, I think you'll see how we need to put our minds in the place in which this was written to properly understand what's being said. He writes, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet. Now, I want to just concentrate on the time we have remaining on these statements, in the Spirit and the Lord's day, because I have something of a novel twist, perhaps, on that last statement that I want to put before you as what I think he's really talking about. But the precise meaning of the first part of this has been the subject of a lot of speculation, but most commentators agree that it indicates that the author is in some sort of a trance-like ecstasy in the reception of the visions that are going to be given to him. And some have argued that the phrase means that John was receiving the visions or information being communicated to him by divine inspiration. Well, I'm not disputing that, but he nowhere makes that statement, and it's far in the book, and it's far more likely that in the spirit refers to this sort of trance-like ecstatic state in which the visions are being given. It's not a code word for these are coming by way of divine inspiration. As I said, I believe they came that way, but that's not what this means in this case. It means a spirit of being in a state of a trance-like state to receive the visions. Now, the second part of the opening verse on the Lord's Day is typically, well, if I say, okay, I'll see you on the Lord's Day, what do we understand that to mean? Sunday. And you'll find if you have a commentary on Revelation or you study this or you listen to whoever you listen to on the radio, that's typically what it's thought to mean. And even, you know, very scholarly commentaries that you might not likely be interested in reading or you definitely wouldn't find in your local Christian bookstore, most of them fall down on the side of, well, it means the Lord's Day, the Christian Sabbath. I think it's worth considering, however, that the author intends to convey something else, either in addition to this being on the Christian Sabbath, that this begins to happen, or instead of that, what we would commonly understand that to mean. I can tell you this, in terms of the evidence that we have, it's not very likely, if we're going to put this on a percentage scale, percentage-wise, it's not altogether likely that John, when he wrote this, or more importantly, the readers or the hearers, would have automatically associated the idea of Sunday with this term. Does anybody have the sign-up sheet? Our CE director is looking for it. Since the content of the apocalypse is directly concerned with matters of grave eschatological import. Now that sounds like a dissertation, doesn't it? What does that mean? What do I mean by that? Somebody tell me. Please tell me I'm not speaking nonsense here. If something is of grave eschatological import, what would that mean? Well, it's important, but what does eschatological mean? Yeah, something related to the end times, something related to the last things. And he's definitely addressing matters like that. I think it's at least plausible, if not more likely, that John here intends to mean the Lord's Day as in the day of the Lord, in its eschatological sense. And as I said, we're likely to read this and read into it the idea of Sunday, when in fact the usage of the phrase the Lord's Day for Sunday is not found in the extant literature. In other words, in all the various manuscripts and writings of the church fathers and all the things that we have, we don't have anything in existence earlier than the 4th century that clearly and obviously links this term, the Lord's Day, with Sunday. And that's not to say that it didn't go on, but in terms of just the hard evidence that we have, there are a few manuscripts that date from the 4th century that link this directly with Sunday. It's an obvious one-to-one correspondence. John didn't write this anywhere close to that time. He was writing in the mid-first century. So that was a much later development. And understanding the phrase within its scriptural context and usage strongly suggests an eschatological meaning based on these following passages. All right, let me do some assignments here. Joel 1:15. Let's quickly go. Okay, Cindy, Joel 2:11. Somebody else, please. John Haig, Joel 2:11. Malachi 4:5. Sam Ogden, you almost got me that time. Matthew 7:22. Okay, Joy. Acts 2:20. Linda DeMeo and 1 Thessalonians 5:2. Jim Flynn and 2 Peter 3:10. Jim Marone, would you look that up? 2 Peter 3:10. I think I've got all these on the board, do I not? Yes. Whether you can read it or not, it's another matter, but anyway. I want you to see that this concept of the day of the Lord, that day, the day, is an idea that has deep roots in Old Testament writing and in the New Testament, and it's associated with the coming of the Lord, some great event in which God breaks into history and causes something remarkable, something history-changing to take place. All right, Joel 1:15. The day of the Lord is near, and as destruction from the Almighty it comes. Joel 2:11. Okay, Malachi 4:5. Matthew 7:22. Now, Jesus here tells that great story about people who cast out demons in his name and all this, and he says, you know, I never knew you. This is the context of this. Matthew 7:22. Who has that? On that day, many will say to me, on that day, a clear reference to, again, an ending, a time of the end. Acts 2:20. This is from Peter's sermon at Pentecost. And he's telling the people that this thing that, and he's quoting, I believe, from the book of Joel there, one of the Old Testament prophets, and he's telling them this thing that God had foretold so many centuries ago, it's come. This is it. It's now here. All this has come. And then in 1 Thessalonians 5:2, just look up 20 verses and you'll find it. Okay, there again, the day of the Lord. And then 2 Peter 3:10. All right, now admittedly, John does not use the term day of the Lord here. He uses the term the Lord's day. But the lack of that kind of specific usage, I don't think negates the possibility that he writes of the same eschatological idea as it's expressed in the various other ways of the phrase, such as in that day or in those days or directly in the day of the Lord. Now, I'll conclude with that. We're